Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy, powered by the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation. Today is two important days. First, it's the inaugural episode of our fourth year of ObserverCast, but enough about us. It's also Inauguration Day in Oklahoma. Last week, we had Organization Day where the legislature met. I believe you passed rules packages, you decided on office supplies, things like that. And then today, our statewide offices were sworn in, and today I was quite amused that of the statewide offices that were sworn in, all but two of them were former legislators. So it's just really entertaining that anti-government folks continue to, you know, on the legislature to statewide office pipeline like we saw today. But more importantly, we have a new minority leader in the House. And I'm just really struck by, you know, what I think we might anticipate in the coming session, because as Representative Cindy Munson said, you know, the Democrats will continue to be the adults in the room. And so today we have Cindy with us to kind of preview this session, to give us a sense of what her leadership will look like for our strappy bunch of Democrats and what she kind of predicts will happen, what we'll see in terms of legislation this year, both from the Republicans and the Democrats. So Cindy, it's great to see you today. I know it's, you know, it's fast and furious already up there at the Capitol, but thanks for joining us. Kind of give us a snapshot of the current Democratic caucus in the House and kind of some of our areas of expertise and what we might expect from our Democrats this year.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me, of course. Happy New Year. It's kind of wild.
Mm-hmm.
23, but it felt like spring out there today during the inauguration ceremony. I say the bright spot from the 2022 election cycle was the House Democrats, because we did not lose a single seat that was up for re-election, and we picked up a seat. We didn't unseat an incumbent. This seat was open in Tulsa, previously held by Carol Bush, and then now Suzanne Schreiber is the new representative, and she is a Democrat. And so that's a huge win for us. It's a great place to start, as I feel like we are in a place of true growth. I think there are more people, and we're getting smarter when it comes to our campaigns. People are paying attention to what Democrats are saying, especially because of some of the issues that you talked about in the intro, especially around education and what's going on with the economy. Because, you know, our leaders will say one thing, and then people's lives are lived and they look a little different. And I think sometimes our leaders at the highest level really have a hard time understanding what everyday people are actually going through. And so, you know, with our membership, we have six new members, and that's really exciting because a new sense of energy. You know, it's just like when you're in school, right? The freshmen are coming in. You're sort of like a, I guess now, what would I be, like a junior? I'll be a senior at where, you know, you want to show them the ropes, you want to tell them how it is, but they also need to learn on their own. I'm still have to realign myself with why I do all of it, but their energy has been great. They're ready to work. They are super smart, and about half of them, if not over half of them, have had some engagement with the state capitol, so they know how the place works. Of course, once you come in and you're a member, it's different, but they're well equipped to do some great things. And then of course our returning members have great experience, and to win their elections, especially Melissa Provenzano, who continues to get targeted by the Republicans. She knocks doors, raises money, do all the things that we need to do to hang on to these red seats. So I'm excited about our caucus. And, you know, we know that there's going to be an attack on public schools because of Governor Stitt and Ryan Walters' election. And then on top of that, we already have seen in the news Republicans who have proposed legislation to harm LGBTQ youth in particular, but really getting in the middle of the decision-making between Oklahomans and their doctors, regardless of what those healthcare decisions are. And then with the where we stand in terms of money in the state and how much revenue we have, which the governor has a hard time recognizing the legislature, who worked really hard to raise revenue, and the federal government, specifically Joe Biden, who has, you know, sent in American Rescue dollars, and that, you know, there's a pot of money that we as legislators helped distribute, but also our state agencies got money. And so not really giving credit where credit is due. And so there is talk about tax, quote unquote, reform, which means tax cuts. And I just hope those of us who have been here in 2016, 17, 18, remember what we went through and will push back on any type of tax cut, unless these are meaningful cuts for working Oklahomans, but it rarely is when we have these conversations.
So do you get a sense, speaking of taxes then, and we know the ultimate goal for a lot of Republicans in leadership roles and the ones who are funding those who are in leadership roles is to eliminate the state income tax altogether, which of course is the fairest tax there is, because everybody in theory pays their fair share based on how much you make and what you're worth. But do you think that there will be a carrot thrown toward workaday Oklahomans when it comes, say, to the grocery tax? I know it's complicated because municipalities rely on funding from that as well. But do you think there might be some momentum there, if nothing else, to try to provide some cover for for the fact that the 1% benefit the most from income tax cuts?
So in the last couple of years, Democrats and Republicans have put forward legislation to cut the state sales income tax on groceries. It was very popular in the election cycle this last year. I mean, both Democrats and Republicans were talking about, the governor was talking about it in his race. The House has, especially during a special session, there were quite a few versions of how we would cut the state sales tax on groceries. But the Senate appropriations chair has come out. I saw on, I think it was on KOCO 5 News here in Oklahoma City, probably right after the election, talk about, that not being a priority for the Senate. And so, I don't know where we'll actually land, but I do know that there's interest from both sides of the aisle. I know that there are, feelings when it comes to our municipalities. And the thing is that's sad that we rely so heavily on a basic necessity that people need to live in order to fund our government, whether it's state government or municipal governments. And so, I just hope it continues to force a conversation on, who we're taxing, how we're taxing them, and what items need to be taxed. I remember standing in line at Target, this was a couple years ago, and there was someone in front of me buying like M&Ms or something. And she said, you have taxes on your food? And she was talking to the cashier, and then she looked back at me and I'm like, does she know I'm a state legislator? Actually, I was like, I am a state representative and I'm a Democrat, and we've worked on, I think she was from Pennsylvania or something. But anyway, so it's shocking for people who come in, to our state, who are in states where that isn't the case, and they have figured it out. So we can figure it out. Whether or not they're, to your question about, folks who need some relief the most, working Oklahomans, will they?
Arnold, you there?
Yeah, we you froze.
We lost that last little bit.
We missed some of what you were saying there, unfortunately.
Do you remember what I said when I stopped?
Yeah, but you were starting to talk about, I think what it would do to the help that it would provide for workaday Oklahomans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was saying that, you know, when we talk about tax reform, or when you, it's not even we, when you hear about tax reform coming out of, you know, this building at the state capitol, it rarely is about working Oklahomans. It rarely is about the people who actually need some financial relief. It's usually about those, you know, at the highest end of our tax bracket. And so the state sales on grocery tax has been a great place for us to come together and have the conversation. It's something people can, you know, the general public understands, because every day they're paying taxes on their groceries to live. And I don't know if this came through, but I was basically saying, you know, the reliance on the revenue that comes in from something so basic as food that we all need to live is funding state government and our municipal governments. But I think we do have to, you know, we can't just stop just because municipalities come and say, well, this is something we rely on. One, we're not even trying to cut local sales tax. We're talking about the state sales tax, which I think is 4.5%. I think anything is better than nothing. And we need to include in the conversation people who would be impacted most in terms of positively impacted by tax cuts. Not the income tax cut, like you said, that is the most fair, that brings the most revenue, that is recurring, that we can plan out, that the budget folks can plan out, so we know what we have to spend to provide services that are critical to everybody, regardless of what spectrum of income, you know, on the spectrum of income that you are on.
Well, we are sitting on a massive pile of money right now, and for a variety of reasons, and some of which, as you noted, was a massive infusion from the federal government. But we are seeing some signs already that things are slowing down. And there's a fair amount of concern, obviously, across the country and around the world about a recession and what that might mean. And we see how quickly, we've seen over the years, how quickly this picture can turn here in Oklahoma, where we're so heavily dependent on so few industries or sources of revenue. And, you know, do you get any kind of sense that are we in this moment where Republican leadership thinks we got to strike while the iron's hot and we've got all this money and this is the time we've got to do it if we're going to cut some more? Or that there are some who are aware that you know, we could put ourselves back in that awful position we were in a few years ago, where we had 30,000 people marching on the Capitol and basically making life miserable for us here because we were, you know, we weren't able to fund core services like they needed to be funded, in that case, public education.
Yeah, I, you know, that's my hope, is that those, and Kevin Wallace is the budget chairman here in the House, and a lot of the subcommittee chairmen are members who were here. We came in together in the sense that, you know, I came in the special, my first session was 2016, and then they got elected in 2016. So 2017, they inherited all of that. And then, of course, we had a teacher walkout. And so my hope is that they will remind themselves, but also educate the new members or those who weren't around, of what we went through. And that right now, and I think the problem is that the governor continues to brag on himself when it comes to savings, which, yes, we need to have some savings. That's why we have the rainy day mechanism, you know, but, you know, to hoard all that money and then sort of blame government that we take so much money and we need to cut taxes and put it back in people's pockets. And like, no, people pay taxes to pay for government services to take care of their needs, roads, bridges, driver's license. I mean, all the things that we need, you know, to function as a society. And so I think they're just what they do best, which is say one thing and then say another thing, whatever sounds good. And tax cuts always sound good. But I think, you know, when it gets down to the details and what impact it could have on our state budget, I would hope that those who have been here Both Democrats and Republicans will stand strong and fight against any type of tax cut. That was the case in the regular session last year. And then when we came back into special session to quote unquote address inflation, you saw some tax cut bills that I don't necessarily think that the budget chairman was excited about. I mean, they ended up not going anywhere, but I don't think there was a lot of enthusiasm behind all of that because he knows what could happen. None of us want to go through that again, or at least I hope not, but we'll see. I'm just like, the thing is, it's, you know, the walkout was, you know, obviously brought a ton of attention to the Capitol, but Arnold, what you were bringing up too, is the day when it was about social services, DHS, mental health, there were people here who have never stepped near the state capitol, coming with their stories in their hand, reading them to me, their hands shaking. Just, these are life and death, you know, situations for many people. And that's not to be hyperbolic or anything like that. It's the truth. And education, of course, is always the area of government that is harmed the most when we make budget cuts like that.
Well, speaking of public education, what's your, I don't know if this is the good way to phrase this or not, but what's your alarm level about the future of public education in Oklahoma, particularly with the governor and the new superintendent and the Senate president, at least, hell-bent on vouchers, and that, which certainly have incredible implications for schools across the state, but particularly in rural Oklahoma, which is interesting, where you don't have a lot of choice. Could this be the beginning of the end of the system as we know it now? Or do you have some faith that there will be pushback and the damage can be averted altogether, or at least somewhat limited in this session?
Yeah, you froze for just a second, but I think you were asking about vouchers and how we're going to stop it, I'm assuming. So there's no doubt that the governor will push some type of voucher program. And I believe him and now State Superintendent Ryan Walters will take their election success as some kind of mandate to us as a legislature and to Oklahomans, when you look at the actual results, and that's not a mandate. They won in an unfair system, in my opinion. But, when it comes to the legislature, the Senate has been, Pro Tem Treat has been pretty open about vouchers. Last year there was, holding the vote open, waiting for one more vote to tip it over to pass. That was a huge deal last session. And then in the House, we've pretty much either been able to stop legislation from coming here, or the education advocates, whether they're on the Democratic side or Republican side, have been pretty vocal about how they feel about vouchers. And so my hope is that we will continue as a House to stand up together, all the Democrats, and then locking arms with rural Republicans in particular, to making sure that these types of programs don't move along. My fear, though, is that what will happen is that they'll figure out a way to get them on board because it won't quote unquote seem as bad as it could be. That's my fear. And my other issue with education right now, and what I experienced on the doors as I was knocking doors, is all of this rhetoric about indoctrination and what teachers are teaching and telling students who they are and who they are not. Like, have you talked to a classroom teacher recently? They're trying to keep butts in the seat, making sure students have everything that they need in order to receive their education. Very basic stuff. My nephew is in pre-K in Oklahoma City Public Schools, and I have gone to two classes so far, that teacher is just trying to keep the classroom under control, And so if we continue to have those conversations, we're going to lose teachers. And then what? So then they get to continue to point to public ed and say, look at how they're failing us. Teachers are leaving and, you know, kids aren't getting the education that they need, but that's on us. It's our responsibility to fund our schools and ensure that teachers have a healthy, safe place to do their job with their students. So those are the two things I worry about: vouchers and then the whole indoctrination rhetoric.
So do you have a theory about how it is that so much of rural Oklahoma voted against its self-interest or the interest of its public schools in this last election? There was a very clear contrast between the Democratic nominee and the incumbent Republican governor, and between the Democratic nominee for state superintendent and the Republican nominee for state superintendent. And I've wondered a number of times if a number of folks out there said, well, my local legislator has assured me that they will oppose them, and so I like what Stitt and Walters and so forth are saying otherwise, or I like what Republicans are saying otherwise, and so they're assuming that firewall will hold.
Yeah. Well, then it's up to them to hold them accountable. I think what happened on a statewide level between Joy and Gina, I thought Gina would be the one who would, you know, make it out with the win, but just barely, right? Because I thought, well, in rural Oklahoma, maybe they'll focus more on the issue of education versus party. And with that particular position, they'll be able to see it better than, you know, who the governor will be. What I think, you know, ultimately happened was, because I've talked to different folks who did some statewide polling who said Joy in particular hung on, really was like pretty close, you know, and then it was like the last 2 weeks she fell off and kind of landed where her, and I don't know what the final result was. Was it 45% or 48%? I can't remember what
her. 41% actually.
Yeah. I was trying to improve the performance.
Yeah, I know.
So, in my dreams. And so I think, you know, my perspective is, until we have stronger local elections, especially at the legislative level, it is going to be really tough for us to get a statewide Democratic candidate over the finish line to a win. And I'm not the type that's like, it's absolutely impossible, but the last few election cycles have shown we're not capable of doing it. And I think it's because, you know, for those of us in the metro area, and look at where we have flipped Republican seats, and now they're sort of like, we're hanging on strong as Democrats. Redistricting, you know, I think, you know, skews some of that for this election cycle. But when you are, it's like when we elected Kendra Horn to Congress, if you look at all the campaigns that were happening in that one area, it was a county commissioner race that was, you know, had a great field program. You had my race. You had two big Senate races with Carrie Hicks and Julia Kurt. Other strong House races. So that's only going to help the person at the top. Because at one point I stopped talking about myself and I was talking about Carrie Hicks, Julia Kurt, and Kendra Horn. And so until we get to a place where we are, you know, a little more balanced in the legislature, stronger campaigns in some of the areas outside of just Tulsa and Oklahoma City. And by that, I mean, Edmund Lawton, those areas, I don't see as pushing a candidate over the top. So I think that has something to do with it. Because like you said, Arnold, I believe people do very much care about their public schools. I think in some sense, they do trust their local legislator to fight for their schools. And that's the person they know, right? That's the person who's either knocked their doors or they've interacted with or has come to their schools. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. As my friend Melly Blancett always says, deeds, not words. So we'll see in this upcoming session if they actually do what they say they're going to do. But it will unfortunately be up to the school district, you know, the schools and the parents to apply pressure. Make sure they remember, you know, don't forget we are here and we are watching what you're doing.
So, you know, kind of with that in mind, I mean, The filing deadline is still next week, and so we don't really fully know what all legislation will be up for consideration. But give us a sense of the good and the bad that you see coming.
The bad, I guess I'll start there. I think attacking trans youth and gender affirming care has become the new abortion. That's the new issue that is, splitting us and keeping this target on our doctors' backs. I do think there will still be bills that, talk about abortion in some sense. It'll never be enough for some of them here. So I think there are going to be a lot of conversations about that. And here's the deal. That's not to the point of what I was trying to say at the state chamber. This is not just a quote unquote social issue. You're talking about healthcare, meaning doctors. Yeah. Stay here, won't stay here. If we continue to threaten to criminalize them because they won't do, or they're doing things that for whatever reason you don't agree with, creating a hostile environment for them, that hurts all of us. How do you build a workforce when people aren't healthy or they don't have access to healthcare, especially after expanding Medicaid, some work we did with ARPA in terms of, getting some dollars to rural hospitals, harming all of that work that we've done. So that's a huge issue that I do believe will be front and center in this upcoming session. Some good things. I'm trying to figure out what exactly I don't know outside. They don't ever put their good stuff forward. They always put the more
inflammatory. Yeah.
Say this, that there seems to be a concerted effort around, a lot of us are talking about higher education and career tech alongside common education. And the chancellor has built pretty good relationships out here, being new and talking about, how do we expand programs like Oklahoma's Promise? How do we ensure that we're funding higher ed to train up the workforce that, everybody's asking for? And so I think, and I don't know specific policies that'll come out of the majority. I always have an interest in expanding Oklahoma's Promise. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how far that goes. But also the speaker had mentioned some possibilities on working a little bit more on occupational licensing. Right now, if you're a state, that is the case for state employees as well. But if you have an occupational license that you're required to do your job, if you get behind on your taxes, your license can be revoked. And, that really doesn't make sense. Folks got to work in order to pay their taxes. And so that's an issue that I've worked on for quite a few years, specifically around folks who are coming out of incarceration. And so I'm glad to hear that we'll continue some work there to, stop punishing people and help them keep their license, attain a license, and go and do their job, because I think those are necessary. But I am, just going back to the voucher conversation, I am hopeful in terms of the coalition that has been built, at least in the House, between Republicans and Democrats who have said no. And so it'll be interesting to watch that group in particular, or us in particular, who to see how strong, especially the rural Republicans will stay. But I still think a lot of social issues, healthcare, curriculum, what we're teaching or not teaching in our schools, banned books, all these things are going to continue, unfortunately.
Well, and it's not just, I was thinking about the punitive nature aimed at someone who holds an occupational license and who may get behind on their taxes and could have that revoked. I guess under the rules now, your vote could be revoked if you're not holding your mouth just right or smiling at the appropriate time, if you're found to be in violation of the House rules, right? I mean, this is a fascinating, very autocratic approach to governance.
Right. Yeah. You know, and it's all, you know, based on dress code and decorum. And here's the deal, especially with dress code, you know, someone wearing a t-shirt or someone wearing a suit jacket, the vote is the vote, right? What I will say is the way, you know, that I would have preferred us address something like that, because I do believe in decorum. And yes, you're setting a certain standard on the floor. Like, I get all of that. I'm not saying we don't have any type of decorum. But if a member is not wearing the dress code, or they have a dip in their mouth, which is part of that rule change, is tobacco, then don't get on the floor. That has typically or traditionally been the case. But to allow the presiding officer to have that much power to decide, you know, they'll argue, well, we've listed out exactly what you can and can't do. Not really, because, you know, if it's ultimately up to the presiding officer, they can decide what is, you know, not following decorum in the house, and then strip away a person's vote. It'll be fascinating to see, which we know it won't, but it would be fascinating to see that happen on the Republican side. I would love to see them strip their members of their voice, whether or not, you know, they, you know, hold it fairly between us and the Republicans, we'll see. But I don't think so. And by the way, we're not a part of that process, you know, that committee process. We, in fact, I did bring up, you know, one of my suggestions was, if we need to address those types of things, how do we do it where it's not so punitive and not shining so much of a light on, you know, individual members? Because it's not just targeting members in the minority, they are targeting members in the majority. But that, to me, doesn't make it fair. Targeting members at all creates a hostile environment, and then to threaten taking away the one thing we have that we are supposed to do for our jobs is vote.
Well, what's the genesis of this? You know, are there specific examples that you can point to that people are like, oh, that's clearly not the august decorum of the Oklahoma House of Representatives?
This is Marie Turner, correct?
Well, yes. Thank you. I was trying to figure out how to say this is really about one member almost.
Yes.
To me.
Am I wrong? I mean,
you are not wrong. And they are also, but they, with the tobacco and t-shirts, they are targeting members of their caucus. I don't know exactly who. I have a couple people in mind, but I have been one when someone comes and talks to me about dress code, I say fascinating, because there's dip on the floor. And so, to me, dip on the floor, you know, spitting in a cup on the House floor of the Oklahoma House of Representatives, to me, is more offensive than, you know, are you wearing a t-shirt under your blazer or a hoodie under your blazer? If you're still within the parameters of the dress code. And so, what it's about is, yes, targeting one of our members, but also, again, it's this whole idea of power and control. I'm going to watch and see what you're doing. If I don't like you and you're doing something that I don't like, I'm going to figure out a way to control you. And that's how I perceive all of it. And that's not good for any of us.
Well, I mean, just how they trying to disguise bigotry under the name of decorum, you know, I mean, I don't think Maury, you know, Representative Turner would mind if, you know, we just blatantly call it for what it is with what they're doing with these, you know, line item, you know, these restrictions on what you can do and how you can dress on, you know, the floor of the house. And it's amazing. They don't really have any new tactics in the playbook. You know, it's everything that they're pulling is, you know, just trying to restrict certain performances, make sure we all can, you know, conform to certain ideals and looks. And it's quite astonishing the lengths that they'll go to target a member. Mm-hmm. For no reason at all.
Mm-hmm. And it's indicative of just the larger, the bigger problem we have in society right now, is if you don't look like me, sound like me, talk like me, you know, worship like me, then there's must be something wrong with you. How do we box
you? Right.
And we should be setting an example that, you know, look, we're elected by the people. the people brought us here. The people hold us accountable to those things, you know, the things that we're doing on the floor, especially when it comes to our vote. And you may not like me, or you may not like one of the members of our caucus and vice versa, but the people sent us here and you have to respect that.
And along those lines, the 30,000 people that live in Representative Turner's district matter as much as the members, you know, the residents of any other member's district, right? So they chose her. They want Representative Turner to be at the House. That should be respected in the way that she, and the way that they represent their district, right? It's just, I mean, I don't know. You can just see the way that they have to, you know, contort ideology to try and get Representative Turner to fit into a certain mold. But that then is extrapolated, you know, across so many Oklahomans. It's just shocking. So,
which I don't even know that the public has any idea what House rules are now until what's happened in the United States House.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think they do. Like, I don't think most Oklahomans know that you guys can't call each other by each other's names when you're addressing each other on the floor. Like, those little elements of things that you can and can't do. Like, you know, I mean, and I don't know if that just shows like how unimportant it really is, or
or just, you know, I think back on when I was first elected, my dad, I think it was about my office or my seat. I think it was my office, because I was on the third floor and I said, you know, I'm technically on a Republican floor because there aren't any more offices left on the Democrat floor. And my dad's like, what? You are separated by parties? And it really is. Yep. It's those little things that people don't realize.
They'd be shocked. Would be shocked how partisan it is in that building.
Yeah. And then
absolutely shocked.
And I'm like, but the structures don't even allow us really to work together. So, but I was sad to be away from the caucus, but it did help me build relationships. And I think, quite frankly, by going by class, I mean, it is, I need to be near my members, but it is interesting. Just, I think seats on the floor more so than offices, you can do that by seniority and leadership or something like that, you know, at least for some kind of relationship building organically, or, you know, or I guess you're not forcing it. If it's not organic, if you're forcing it, but at least in a way that, like, in any other office situation, you know.
Well, but, you know, I forget who it was that told me that in Congress specifically, you've seen a lot of the decorum and a lot of the camaraderie go downhill when the Republicans came into power and changed the schedule. And so members of Congress weren't together as much, their families weren't going to the same schools. And so just that like forced socialization really makes a difference, right? So when you see the segregation in the House and even in the Senate, you know, I remember when the construction was going in, the Democratic Senate offices were up in an attic somewhere, you know, like, I mean, it's just, it is the lack of equity, you know, and I mean, it says a lot, and I just don't think the public knows just how, like, stringent it is. It's a thing. It's seriously a thing there. So yeah, I mean, just like not having contact with each other in the same way, I think does make a huge difference in, you know, coming to terms and coming to agreements and compromise and consensus and all that sort of stuff. So, but I've got to take a kid to dance. So if you guys want to continue, you know, the conversation, please don't stop because of me. But I mean, I think, you know, Cindy, like, this will not be a boring session.
No,
to the imagination, even though it's not an election year, this will not be a boring session.
The election year session, you know, deal is over. That ended for me, I think, in going into the 2020 election cycle. In fact, I made that joke with OETA today, which is, you know, we used to say, oh, it's an election year, so it's going to be crazy. No, it's every session now. There's enough to go around, apparently. So yeah.
Well, let me ask one last thing here, and that I'm just curious about. Even though the Democratic numbers in the House have increased slightly up to 20 now, is there a danger for Republicans that they will so finally radically overreach that it costs them at the ballot box 2 years from now?
Repeat your question. You froze up. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, that's all right. I wonder if it's possible, given the election results in the fall and the governor's claims of a mandate and Ryan Walters' claims of a mandate, blah, 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 that Republicans will so radically over, not that they haven't radically overreached in the past, but I mean, it could go to new levels this year and next in ways that could, in fact, hasten a return to a more sensible politics in this state.
Or can I just add on to that? Or is it possible that John Eccles was just performing for the television when he said that the governor had a mandate? And more importantly, that we will see kind of a backlash or at least some tightening of reins from the legislature in response to Stitt's kind of boneheadedness, at least from the last year. I mean, will we see House and Senate Republicans kind of censure him and bring him back under control by just not passing his initiatives and, you know, not necessarily letting him get away with everything he wants to?
Yeah, there's certainly, I think, you know, any time after an election, although I think this one in particular is interesting because Governor Stitt won't be running for re-election, you know, at least not for governor. He may run for other things. But I think I would guess that would give the Republican leadership more power to say, you know, we're going to be here, you know, just as long as you are. And so and for some, they get to run for re-election again and be here when he's not governor. And so, in my opinion, they have more power in terms of, you know, what it is that they want to get done and what Oklahomans want. But in terms of, you know, things getting more, for me, I think there are plenty of opportunities for Democrats to win legislative seats in the upcoming cycles. And we need to get to 35 in order to have some type of leverage in the House. And there are places that I think have been either overlooked or we have underestimated our ability to execute strong campaigns. And with redistricting, you know, the congressional districts, that's another story. But with the legislative districts, I felt like the process was as fair as it possibly could have been, you know, considering the makeup of the legislature. But you can't gerrymander demographics is what I would always say. And I continue to say, because like I said, Oklahoma City, Tulsa, Edmond, Lawton, and surrounding areas, even the suburban areas of Tulsa and Oklahoma City are just changing. Younger folks are moving in. They care about education. They don't like the social issues and the way we attack people who are different than us. And so it's all about us executing smarter campaigns. And I think that's what will keep the extremism from getting out of hand, more out of hand than it already has. And it's a matter of us continuing to communicate to them. And like Marianne brought up, the whole line of being the adults in the room is to show Oklahomans that, you know, there's a group of people who paint Democrats a certain way. You may think about Democrats at a national level, but, you know, we're trying to show you what it is that we're working on and what we think is important to Oklahomans, and getting away from all of these distractions. The unfortunate thing, though, is that we have to address those distractions, right? They want us to take the bait. They want us to have those conversations. But here's the deal. We're harming people. So we have to speak up, right?
Well, I just hearken back to a conversation right after the election with Jared Deck, the newly elected state representative from Norman, who, you know, lamented, you know, of course, he's worked a lot of campaigns. He's, you know, he's from Thomas, Oklahoma, originally. He's a son of, you know, Western Oklahoma. He's worked a lot of campaigns out that way and a lot of successful campaigns over the years. But, you know, he lamented the fact that, you know, boy, you know, if Democrats had had a sliver of the money that was spent in the governor's race, right, to pour into some of these House races, there would have potentially been, you know, some additional seats that were picked up. But and I think to your point on that, you can't that it's fast. The population changes, the demographic changes, and so forth are fast changing the landscape to the point where you just can't constitutionally create districts that keep those numbers from changing in the legislature. I think, you know, is it as fast as I would like to see it? No, and probably lots of other people who are progressive in their thinking would like to see. But it doesn't take that many seats before you begin to build some momentum, and you can convince people, I think, that you know what, the water is fine. You may have been you may have bought into the nationalizing of elections for a number of years here, but what's it gotten you? And the reality is actually different.
Exactly. And I wholeheartedly agree with Representative Deck that, God, I would joke all throughout the election cycle, if I could have just like a quarter of one of those millions, I could do so much for our candidates. And so, and that's a lot of why I ran for leader, is just my experience. The only way to grow is to flip seats. And it takes a certain understanding and tenacity and work ethic, not just from the candidate, but from their leadership and their leader understanding what it takes. And, you know, having those hard conversations about continuing to do the work, knocking the doors, raising the money. It's not easy. It's not fun. Well, it is. It can be fun. It's not always easy, though, but it's certainly worth it. And if you want it in the sense of you want something to change for Oklahoma, you'll stay at it. And it's incredible the things that you will learn about people, regardless of their party affiliation, when you're knocking their door. There are a lot of folks out there who just aren't fully engaged that align with the things that Democrats have been fighting for a long time.
You know, I argue with people that I can make a case, I think in a pretty strong case, that Oklahoma County is blue now. Mm-hmm. Certainly at the very least purple, but I think blue. Tulsa County is purple, mm-hmm. but it's changing. And I wonder if you look at races like Suzanne Schreiber's pickup over there, and if it doesn't remind you a lot of your seat, in 2015, that, you know, had been in Republican hands for over half a century, including names like Mary Fallon and, you know, Odelia Dank and David Dank, and, you know, in the more recent history of that. But, you know, Republican forever, and it's changed. And I think you're seeing the same thing over in Tulsa. You're seeing it in Payne County. You're seeing it in, I think it's headed that direction in your old stomping ground in Comanche County. Certainly true in Norman.
Yep.
So, yes, there are enclaves of, you know, real conservatism in and around the metro areas. You know, I think out into Canadian County, or I think, you know, up toward Owosso and up that way in Southeast, you know, in around Tulsa. But by and large, it looks like the opportunity is there. The problem is that, you know, I guess you have to be working it right now to have any chance of making breakthroughs for on down the line. So I hope you're really good at multitasking, because you're not only having to stave off things at 23rd and Lincoln this spring, but you're also having to strategize and plot ways to expand the caucus less than 2 years from now.
Okay, sorry about that.
No, that's all right. That's all right. I don't know where I froze up with you, but you know, you've really got to be a multitasker now, because you have to not only you not only have the legislative session here where you're going to be fending off all sorts of things and trying to get some good things done, but you also have no time to waste for the next general election, which is still almost 2 years away. But that's not much time if you're trying to bolster the number.
Yeah, no, it's not much time, and I'm well aware of that. And it's,
not to put any pressure on you.
Oh, yeah. No. This year is, you know, it's like there's going to be a lot of new stuff, a lot on my shoulders, and I'm grateful. You know, the leadership team is strong, and you know, I know that they'll pick up the things that they need to do too, and that is so important, so I can focus also on the things outside of the building, right? fundraising, candidates, making sure, you know, things are in place in order to support them properly. And we had a great group of candidates who ran in this last election cycle, but it's just like, they were almost there, you know, and it takes exactly what happened to me, which is try once, lose, and you just never know what's coming around. You know, I wasn't planning to run in 2016. I was waiting until the seat opened, and then it opened earlier than I could have ever predicted. And so that could happen to one of our, you know, candidates, or someone decides not to run again, or whatever the case may be. And so it's just about perseverance. And if we, you know, are about making Oklahoma better, it gives you so much more motivation to continue to do the hard work and put yourself back out there, because it can't just be about yourself. There's just not, there aren't a lot of perks to it. It has to be about, you know, changing the way our state is doing things.
Exactly. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You've taken up an awful lot of your time when
you're
spinning a lot of plates. So thank you so much for doing that. And now, you know, of course, we want you to come back at some point. So
yeah, so you'll have to check in with me in like March.
Yeah, and we'll see where things are going.
Yeah, there. But I always love joining you all and anytime. But yeah, I appreciate you being patient with me taking a call and the technical issues here.
No, that's all right. Great having you. And we will look forward to continuing the conversation.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Like what you hear on ObserverCast, please tell your friends about us. Also, if you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org.
You also can support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. To help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in our 53rd year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate.
Finally, we want to thank Norman's Jared Deck for the music you're listening to today. You can download his albums at iTunes and learn more at jareddeckmusic.com.